This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to Scholarly Communication. Today I'm speaking with Peter Baldwin, professor of history at UCLA and co-founder of Arcadia Fund, a grant-making institution focused on preservation and open access, among many other things. Peter's latest work is Athena Unbound, Why and How Scholarly Knowledge Should Be Free for All. Athena Unbound examines the history and debates of open access, the practice of making research and scholarly work freely available. Peter, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. You know, I think that this is a great book for a number of reasons. Most importantly, because my work at New Books Network, we care a lot about making sure that scholarly research can be accessed by anyone, no matter where they are. And I feel like you are, in many ways, one of the biggest experts on the topic. So I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about the history of open access. But before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm by training and day job, I'm a professor of history, which means that I've spent a large part of the best years of my life in archives and libraries, and I'm sort of acutely attuned for professional reasons as well as sort of general, what should we call it, political and social reasons, to the idea that the more open knowledge is, the better off we all are. And so seeing it locked up behind paywalls hurts my, professional and scholarly and human sense of justice and the right order of things.
What would you say that was the main inspiration for you in writing this book, just your own personal experience, or was there a particular event, story, thing that you learned that made you inspired to write this book?
There wasn't any particular event. It's just that I sort of see on a daily basis those of my friends, colleagues, peers, and other people who don't happen to be professors of history or somehow connected to major universities with significant research libraries. I know that they are simply unable to access the kind of stuff that the professoriate within the academic bubble, has at its fingertips and takes for granted. And that seems to me significantly unfair. Add to that, of course, the fact that 99.5% of the population of the industrialized world has no access to these academic resources. And if you look at the global South, of course, the situation is even more extreme. So here we have this remarkable outpouring of scientific productivity that has, done nothing but grow, especially after the Second World War, an enormous sort of flow of knowledge and scholarship. And yet it's reserved for a tiny fraction of humanity, except insofar as somebody has some connection to a research library. In the old days, in the analog system, paper and binding and so forth, you could always tell people, well, you have to go to a library like everybody else and sit there and read the books. But in this day and age of digital availability, it's even more unfair that some people have it all at their fingertips on their laptop and others are sort of cut out of it altogether.
You explore the idea of information or knowledge wanting to be free. So I was wondering if you could just kind of elaborate on this idea, what you mean by information wanting to be free.
Well, this is not my mantra and not my idea. It is the slogan comes from elsewhere, as indicated in the book. And it is, in a sense, the founding idea of the open access movement that knowledge wants to be. And, you know, in a general sense, there obviously is something to this. There's no question that over the course of human history, with the development of printing and the ever-increasing sort of availability of knowledge in a technical sense, that information has become much more freely available than it was in the past. We don't have monastic libraries with the books chained to the shelves and available only to the members of the monastery, you know, that sort of thing, as one did earlier. But, you know, having said that, it's also true that a great deal of information doesn't want to be free. The bulk of all scholarly scientific research is sponsored by corporations. 2/3 to 3/4 of it is proprietary corporate research and its output. And that obviously doesn't want to be free and isn't likely to be free anytime in the immediate future. We're talking really only about, you know, a small fraction of all scientific output when we look at university scholarship. And then it's good to keep in mind the fact that this sort of scientific output, of course, is only a tiny fraction of the overall landscape of all content. All the books that are sold, or rather that are written to be sold, the vast majority of music, especially pop music, the vast majority of films, theater, symphony, you know, everything that is, generally speaking, content except for scholarly literature tends not to want to be free in the sense that those who produce it hope to make a living off of it and therefore, you know, want to be paid for it. Now, the brutal reality is that the vast bulk of the content that wants to be paid for isn't, and that the vast majority of content producers who would like, in an ideal world, to live off of selling their content, in fact, don't. You know, various scholarly authors associations have, you know, taken surveys of their members, and the brutal reality that they reveal is that it's a tiny, tiny fraction of authors who actually live off their writing. So you could say that even among those people who would like to live off their content, if they acknowledge that they're unlikely to do so, they may discover that their interests are also served by making their content more easily available, rather than trying to sell it and reaping, you know, a pittance in royalties for the few books that they actually manage to convince somebody to buy. So we're talking about the kinds of people who ought to be interested in open access are fundamentally scholars who make their living in the university world, the research world, the research institute world, and who are paid for their work. And therefore, there's really no need for them to be paid again. And then possibly, and here, of course, it's much harder to define who we're talking, those content producers who recognize that they're not going to live off their content and might be interested in a larger audience rather than more royalty.
You get into a little bit of the history of copyright. I was wondering if you could give some background just to sort of set the scene before we sort of get into what the current state of affairs is for copyright and open access.
Well, copyright is the system that protects intellectual property. And it started in the early 18th century and then developed rapidly in the 19th century. And effectively, what copyright has done is allow those who produce ideas and content, writings, paintings, you know, whatever it is that intellectual property consists of, it allows them to attempt to sell what they now legally possess. Before the era of copyright, in effect, they couldn't possess their own products because anyone could take them and copy them, rip them off, and there was absolutely no legal mechanism to prevent them from doing so. So copyright, in that sense, made content producers property owners. Now, the problem is that in the beginning, copyright gave a limited protection, allowing them to sell for a short period of time. And then after that, the content went into the public domain and it was available for anyone to use anywhere in any way. In the beginning, copyright law protected content for 14 years. If you wanted to, you could usually renew it, so maybe 28 sort of at the outside, and after that, it went into the public domain. The problem is that copyright was lengthened increasingly over the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries to the point we are now, where a standard copyright term is life of the author plus 70 years. So we're talking, you know, unless you die at the age of Mozart in your 30s, we're talking well over a century worth of protection. And since the reality for most content is that it loses its commercial attractivity, its commercial potential shortly after being launched onto the market. In fact, what we're doing is locking up content that nobody is paying for any longer after the first few years after publication, after dissemination. We're locking it up for, you know, well over a century where nobody can do anything with it, even though nobody's paying for it. So it's not that it's worthless in a commercial sense, in a narrowly commercial sense. It's, of course, has a worth to those who want to read it, but we've locked it up in the sort of the, you know, the completely quixotic expectation that it retains value for a long time. Now, for those few works that are lucky enough to in fact retain value for over a century, obviously there's nothing against those who produce it, the publishers and the authors and the rights holders in general, from marketing and you know, and deriving the value that they've produced. I've got nothing, and I don't think anybody in the sort of what we call the reasonable open access world has anything against people who have produced something of value that maintains its value from continuing to do so. But let's be clear, we are talking about an infinitesimal amount of the total content landscape here. And the rest of it, because of this need to protect a tiny fraction, is sitting there locked up when it could be available for use by anyone. And that seems like an enormous downside for comparatively small upside.
So for, you know, present day authors and scholars who are listening to this conversation and they're interested in open access, but are also concerned with, you know, the prospects of making a living, you know, how can authors think about making a living simultaneously while also pursuing open access? Is there a way to make this work without necessarily holding some sort of university position or another job?
That is a tough one. You know, when this issue is discussed in the music world, you know, the usual approach has been, well, you know, it's not just selling records or whatever, the, you know, downloads these days. You know, you can also tour and that sort of thing. For people who, you know, write plays or novels or poems, that's not quite the same. There is no, you know, real alternative source of income, you know, public readings, I guess, but who pays for that? And so it's a very tough question for those who produce the kind of content that they want to sell commercially. For scholars, I don't see the big deal, because scholars are paid, and many of them are paid not only decent, but, you know, quite good wages for doing what they do, especially those who are the ones who produce a lot of content. They tend to be rewarded within the scholarly system, and it's very hard to see why exactly they, you know, need to be rewarded again. Having said that, I also want to add that there are very few scholars within the system who actually either expect any royalties or can make any pretense to earning any royalties. We are talking about a tiny fraction of the overall professoriate. If you look at science professors, for example, scientists within the university world, who are the bulk of all university faculty and researchers these days, they have never sold their content. Scientific journals, ever since their establishment, first in the, you know, 16th, early 17th century, have never paid for content. They publish in order to gain the recognition of their peers, to, you know, claim priority for their discoveries, generally sort of to be lauded for their insight and their acumen, and not for the money at all. They get paid their salaries. Now, obviously, some of them produce discoveries that are patentable and that are valuable on the market. But for them, there's a sort of a separate ecosystem whereby, insofar as they produce something patentable and therefore valuable, they tend to split the proceeds with their university. And, you know, in the few cases, they leave the university altogether and then, you know, become entrepreneurs in effect. But most of them share the profits with the university. And those kinds of scientists are, you know, again, a small minority of engineers, medical scientists, and people like that. The bulk of university scientists are not paid anything other than their salaries and are content with that. And the same goes fundamentally for the social sciences and humanities, with a few exceptions. And indeed, I'd be willing to argue that the biggest exception is my own field, history, which is one of the rare spots where academic historians can also hope to produce commercially viable products of their own thinking and learning, you know, that the public wants to read. You know, academic philosophers, nobody buys books, you know, written by them. Academic sociologists, forget it. You know, political scientists, maybe, if it's sort of presidential biography or something like that, or about, you know, current politics. But on the whole, really, historians, and then that even means, you know, historians writing about, you know, Winston Churchill, the Second World War, Napoleon, the Civil War, you know, those are potboiler topics that still sell books. Again, we're talking about a tiny minority of one small fraction of one part of the academic world who have any expectation ever of writing a book that might bring in some royalty. So this is, you know, to tailor everything according to them would really be sort of doing so for the exception and not for the rule.
So yeah, with some of that background in mind, you know, I was wondering if you could talk specifically about the just kind of history of the open access movement, and you know, where you sort of see the open access movement evolving to now.
Well, the history, open access requires digitality, requires digital technology. So, you know, before digital technology could sort of start reproducing, well, really everything, and before that was then in turn spreadable through the internet, there was no ability to be open access. In the analog world, you still had to meet the physical cost of printing, reproducing, distributing, binding, shelving, shipping, you know, all the sort of everything that went into sort of the physical media that stuff was transmitted through. With digitality, all that evaporates. The first copy of anything still costs money to produce, but the last copy at the margin, is effectively costless to produce and to disseminate. And that's what makes open access possible. So it's not until, you know, what, the 1990s or so, when these things come together, that there's anything to discuss. Now, after that, however, things slowly start heating up and the possibility of open access sort of gradually unfolds. Let me add one proviso, which is to say that there are certain professions that were doing effectively what open access dissemination is now doing already in the analog era. And that is, for example, physicists who were, back before there was anything like the internet, were Xeroxing copies of their preprints, of their articles before they submitted them to journals, and were sending them at great cost and, you know, an aggravation through the postal system to their colleagues and asking sort of for them to, you know, comment and so forth. And by the time a paper was finally published in a journal, you know, effectively everyone in the field had already read it in preprint on paper, having arrived, you know, with a stamp and an envelope and that sort of thing. That now is what is going on in many of the academic disciplines, instantaneously, effortlessly, and, you know, brilliantly by use of the internet. But the idea of sending what effectively is not yet a printed object around to your colleagues existed already before digitality, but it was sort of turbocharged by the onset of the digitality. And we're now in the situation where, you know, everybody has broadband. Those of us of a certain age can remember, you know, dial-up modems and stuff like that when it was still hard to get stuff. Attachments, you know, I can remember attachments, you know, one of the glories of the internet when suddenly you would send a paper or a chapter or something like that through the internet. We take it now completely for granted. That wasn't always so. But, you know, the internet is now at a stage where it is effortless to send stuff to your colleagues. It is costless and effortless to post something that you write up on the web for the entire world to read. The entire world may not want to read it, but insofar as it does, it's up there and they can access it. It can access it as freely and costlessly as it pleases. So we are now in a kind of digital nirvana where everybody can be connected to every bit of information that we put up there. And so the bizarre contrast that we live with is that all this is possible, and yet things are still so locked down, and it's sort of the squaring the circle that the open access movement is about. It is, you know, how to pay the costs of dissemination for material whose cost reduction have already been met. Nobody's talking about, you know, the cost of producing this material. That's a totally separate issue. You know, in the humanities and social sciences, people tend to do it largely under their own steam with the salaries that they're paid. In the sciences, there are huge scientific budgets that pay for the production of content. You know, in America, for every scientific article published, and globally there are about 2 or 3 million published every year, every scientific article published has on average almost $300,000 of scientific research funding behind it. So there's a huge amount of money invested in every scientific article that's out there. The cost of actually transmitting those articles freely to the world is as little as $10 if you're talking about posting it on some kind of preprint repository, and as much as $9,000 or $10,000 if you're talking about publishing open access in one of the most exploitative journals, science or something like that. But anyway, even at $10,000 a pop, it's a tiny fraction of the cost of producing the research behind that article in the first place. So open access is really only talking about how to meet the cost of disseminating the information whose costs for production have already been met by governments and other third-party funders.
You know, as far as like specific examples are concerned, you know, who are some of the most important distributors and disseminators of free information? You know, are there any particular websites or particular organizations that you would tell someone who's maybe living in a place where they can't access or, you know, they don't have a school affiliation, but they still want to engage? Like, where should they go to learn?
Do you mean as a reader or as a writer?
Both. Yeah. Maybe first as a reader and then second as a writer.
Well, okay. So as a reader, if you don't have whatever it takes to get into the digital riches of academic institutions and research libraries, you don't have much choice. Some public libraries subscribe to some databases, you can get into them. You know, the New York Public is a major research library, and if you go to the New York Public, you can get into lots of things you couldn't otherwise, but your local branch library is, you know, highly unlikely to get you into JSTOR or Ion Online or any of the other big social science databases that I know about, and God knows what it's the case with other databases. So there's not much to be done. You still have to go into a research library, and that means you have to have some sort of connection or affiliation. Now, the result of that is that there are these pirate sites like SciHub and Z-Library and others that make pretty much the bulk of scientific literature available for free anywhere in the world. They are, of course, in violation of every conceivable copyright law. Some of them exist, like SciHub, somewhere in the East Bloc, or what we used to call the East Bloc, I mean, Belarus or someplace like that. I don't know quite for sure where it is. Others like Z-Library are sort of play whack-a-mole, and every time they get shut down in one place, they pop up in another. And anyone can go there and download lots of stuff. And the interesting little, or the dirty little secret of the modern academic world is that lots of academics have also inhaled in that sense, because even people who have access to their own university libraries, you know, to get into them these days, you have to go through, you know, climb these endless, sort of jump these endless hoops of two-stage verification or whatever to finally get into the library, and then you can sort of look at this stuff. So lots of people just go to SciHub and, you know, just as a matter of convenience. So, you know, the absolute largest number of users of SciHub come from China, which makes sense because the Chinese don't have access to all this stuff. But the second largest are Americans, many of whom, no doubt, have perfectly good access to this stuff, but just can't be bothered. And therefore, so this is, of course, something that, you know, if you write about these things, you have to sort of be polite and say, well, of course, these are illegal and no one should do this. But the reality is that there's no way of avoiding, it seems to me, the conclusion that the scientific publishers have largely brought this upon themselves by virtue of being almost impenetrable, that you can get into their riches if you have some affiliation, but that's a tiny fraction of humanity. And if you don't, then you bump up against the paywalls, and the paywalls are grotesque. I mean, I'm sure you've seen examples of this, but, you know, you go to some media source that charges a reasonable rate for its content, like Spotify or Apple Music or Netflix or something. You know, Netflix or is like whatever it is these days, you know, $12 for 10,000 movies. You know, it's a really good deal as a lending library goes. A lot of content for a reasonable price, and people seem to be willing to pay for it. But if you go and try to get an academic article and you bump into the paywall, and then you then look at what it is that you have to pay to be allowed to read it, it's just bizarre. My favorite example, and it's in the book there somewhere, is that it's very common practice that it costs more to read the review of a book than it does to buy the book itself. And when you've gotten to that point, you just realize, you know, the publishers are just effectively making it impossible for any normal person to get in. And then you wonder, why do they go to the illegal websites, to the pirate sites? It seems pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, I remember, I won't name them, but I was speaking with a professor who told me that they were really thrilled when they saw that two of their books were on LibGen, because it meant that they finally made it.
You know, that's very interesting. I'm delighted to say all my books are on SciHub. And it's a mark of it's a mark of some kind of prestige. I assume it means that somebody, may not be more than one or two people out there, but has thought it worthwhile to put it up there. And I couldn't be happier.
Should like indie bookstores feel threatened by open access, or do you think that ultimately, you know, more people reading books, regardless of if they're paying or not, will still help the general community of readers?
Well, a couple of points on that. What percentage of indie bookstores' content is scholarly monographs? I'm guessing pretty small, right?
Yeah, very little. Not almost.
Yeah, right. So that's not really what we're talking about. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I try to belabor this point in the book. I am talking in the book only about scholarly works. So that means scientific articles and scholarly monographs, which are a little harder to define, and there's a lot of overlap with the sort of commercial content. I have nothing against novelists and poets and so forth trying to earn a living from their books, and I think they ought to, and I think they ought to sell them in bookstores. And yes, it's lovely to go to an indie bookstore if you're lucky enough to have one nearby to buy these, and not just order them off of Amazon or whatever it is that people generally do these days. And the other question is, what does open access actually do for physical book sales? And there, the jury is out, as far as I can see. A lot of people argue that that having a book that's open access actually stimulates interest, and you end up selling more copies of the physical book than you would had it not been the case. And publishers, will tell you, oh no, that's not the case. Our sales are actually absolutely decimated. Now, this recent, the recent court case, Hachette against the Internet Archive, some of the data that was provided there, it obviously didn't tip the court's opinion against the way that it went, but some of the data there came from the University of North Carolina Press during the COVID epidemic, when they joined the sort of spirit of things in the Internet Archive's Digital Emergency Library and put some of their, or possibly all, I'm not quite sure the details, of their monographs up available freely, whether for reading or for download, again, I'm not quite sure. But in any case, their sales during the epidemic went up, even though they were doing it. So whatever the mechanism, whether it's people had a look at the book and then said, oh, I sort of actually want that and then bought it, or whether it's just two parallel but not connected events, I don't know. But they didn't actually come out worse, even though they opened up their lists to a certain degree. So it seems to me this is something that, we need a biblical case on this. Does open access stimulate or suppress sales of physical books? It would be extremely interesting to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I would also be really, really curious to see what the results would be. And I think my expectation is that it wouldn't, because I'm definitely a person that has made use of open access, and I think I buy a lot of books too. So, I frequently will buy books, and I also buy the audiobook, and I'll get a torrent of the same book. So that I'll have three copies, and I've paid for it twice. It looking towards the current moment and also the future, because not only are you a historian of open access, but you also are a person actively involved in it. Where do you sort of see the future of open access? What are your hopes and dreams, and maybe also your fears?
Well, I think open access is inevitable in the long run, and I think we're getting there quicker than we would have imagined, let's say, 5 years. But, and there's a big caveat here, the way we're getting there is that the scientists have basically managed to sort of jiggle the system so that it works on their behalf. And they've done so in so far as scientific publishers have raised their rates. They did so back in the 70s and 80s, before digitality at all, in what we usually refer to as the serials crisis, when they raised their subscription fees and gutted research library acquisitions budgets that had to be drained off towards the scientific publishers, leaving very little left for buying academic monographs in the humanities and social sciences, and that they've just continued into the open access era. So that instead of using open access and digitality as a means of cutting costs, which should be perfectly possible for reasons we come back to, the scientific publishers have just maintained their prices, except that instead of calling them subscriptions for journals, they now call them article publishing fees or charges. The money is largely the same. The profit margins of those publishers who do really well, 30 to 40%, haven't changed much in the open access era. So as far as they're concerned, open access is fine, so long as the article publishing charges bring in profit margins that are more or less the same as their inflated subscription charges. And that seems to be the case at the moment. The result is that for scientific literature, it is all moving quite rapidly towards open access. And I think in another 5 years, we'll all be completely open access. But the library budgets that pay in the old days for subscriptions, nowadays they are taken away by deans who need to pay the article publishing charges for their faculty. Instead, those resources are no longer available to pay for humanities and social science output. And so the real problem with open access is not so much taking care of the scientific output. That is sort of happening already. The real problem is, what are we going to do now that we don't have the money we used to for humanities and social science output? What are we going to do to make that open access as well? And there, you know, it's sort of a hodgepodge of sort of small dorm solutions that have been put together. There are lots of little presses that have sprung up that charge less than, you know, the normal conventional academic presses to publish a book, that are cheaper in that sense. There are journals that are been set up, sometimes diamond open access, so that the author doesn't pay because they have funds from somewhere else, the donor or something like that. Libraries, you know, have sort of colluded, that's the wrong word, it sounds like a criminal conspiracy, have cooperated so that, you know, it's, instead of 100 of them, you know, paying for a book, they get together and pay the open access publisher that the open access charge for the book, and then make it free for everybody in the world, not just having a library. So, you know, there are ways of doing this, but the problem is, it's all sort of, it's small scale, it's unpredictable, it's a little unclear. Many of these publishers, because they're small scale, are they going to be there in 10 years? And if they're not, where are those files that have, with the open access books that they published? Or who's taking care of them? It's all a bit unclear. And I think what we need, what we obviously need, is a great deal more regularity and predictability in the humanities and social science end of open access.
That's a really great point about this kind of the bifurcation in between the different ways in which, you know, science versus, you know, social sciences, humanities might be operating in the open access field. You know, my final question for you is, you know, in addition to, you know, going out and checking out your book, Athena Unbound, which I will say, of course, is an open access book, so people should have no problem getting it. Are there any other resources that you might recommend that professors or other scholars might go to learn a little bit more and maybe get involved in some capacity?
Well, and you asked me this beforehand, I could have thought about it, but off the top of my head, the best I can do is my friend and colleague John Walensky has also just published a new book on open access, the title of which I don't remember off the top of my head, but available.
I'll add it in the show notes.
Please. Okay. On open access, MIT Press, a very interesting, sort of more theoretical approach to how to solve the problem. He has a solution that's extremely intriguing, that basically applies the kind of leasing model that we have already for music to books, so that you know, if they're not available on the open market at a reasonable price, then you sort of compulsory license them in a way that if you want to record somebody's song that has already been recorded, you have the right in copyright law to do so, and the original composer songwriter can't do anything about it. His idea is to apply a similar legal model to academic literature. Just, you know, an intriguing idea. We'll see where it goes.
So yeah, so to John Walensky on open access. Well, Peter, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.